Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Financial advisors nationwide are issuing dire warnings about our country's fiscal future, with talks of a looming recession circulating headlines for months. Some economists still say a global recession isn't likely to happen soon, but other finance executives have predicted otherwise. One thing we do know for certain is that today's record high inflationary environment, and in turn, the Federal Reserve's swift tightening, is signaling a potential economic downturn ahead. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Though there are a number of recession indicators to consider in the bigger picture, it's no doubt that recession fears are leaving many people feeling uncertain about their financial future. A CNBC All-America Workforce survey taken in June found that more than 80% of working adults are worried about a recession. That tops their concerns about nearly every other issue facing Americans today. And no matter what happens with the economy, it's never a bad idea to check in with your money habits to set yourself up to be in the most secure financial position possible. That way, you can stress less about what happens with the economy when you build the most stable foundation possible. Today, we delve into the do's and don'ts of managing your money at a time when the national financial outlook is difficult at best. We're happy to take your personal finance questions, too. Call 800-780-9742 or email questions to ideas at WPR.org. Our featured guest today is Kevin McKinley. He is owner of McKinley Money LLC, an independent registered investment advisor with offices in Madison and Eau Claire. He is also author of the book Make Your Kid a Millionaire. Kevin, welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's great to have you.
Hello, Shereen.
So how is a recession technically defined, and who decides, who says ultimately, hey, we're in a recession now?
Well, you know, it's actually there are several different bodies that track all of this and declare it one way or the other. But, you know, what they say is that a recession is when your neighbor loses his or her job, and a depression is when you lose your job. And so that's what really guides it. Is as much as you might read the headlines about, you know, rising prices or whatever is going on in the economic data, it's really how it affects you individually that you really feel it. And that's part of the reason why, you know, people are so concerned about gas prices, because that's such an automatic, immediate, and very real effect on your pocketbook when you just that dial just keeps spinning and doesn't seem to stop. And it's very alarming to people. And so it's where it hits you personally that really matters.
Well, a lot of people certainly feel like we're in a recession, but are we? What is your opinion?
Actually, no. We're not in a general recession by the statistical definition of it at all. Unemployment is extremely low, and one of the biggest issues in the economy right now is there just aren't enough workers for the available jobs, at least at the wages that are being paid, and that's due to several reasons. But in terms of the economy sliding back, no, this morning there were a bunch of new job openings that were a pleasant surprise. And so, it's an economic turmoil, but the recession is a probable event, I think, in the future, but we're not there yet.
Well, historically, recessions have typically follow the Fed raising interest rates, and they do that to combat inflation. How crucial are those decisions that are made by the Federal Reserve, and how do they figure out what is exactly the right balance? How much is too much?
I think if you ask them, they would say, we haven't figured it out yet. We're not quite sure yet. And the Federal Reserve definitely is probably one of the prime factors in driving the economy. Kind of interest rates act like a brake pedal and a gas pedal in a car. And they've had their foot on the gas for years and if not decades in terms of lowering interest rates, and in some cases artificially lowering interest rates so that they could hopefully keep the economy stable and moving forward and upward. The problem with that is with so much money flooded into the world over the last 2 years now, a lot of that money is chasing after a limited goods of services and limited amount of workers available to work. And so that's what's driving interest rates up. And finally, the Federal Reserve said, you know what, we are more worried about inflation than we are about putting the economy into the recession. So we're going to hit the brake pedal by raising interest rates.
Let's talk a little bit about inflation. It's on everybody's mind right now. We talk about inflation all the time in the last few weeks especially. But it feels like inflation is something that's completely out of our control. But is there something that we can do individually to help combat inflation?
In terms of rising prices, absolutely. There's not much you can do at the gas pump as you're seeing that numbers keep spinning and spinning as you fill up your tank. But in terms of your own personal life, absolutely. One of the best things that people can do is to try to analyze their spending and say, okay, we were spending, let's just say, $4,000 a month in our household. And now because of inflation, we're now spending $4,500. Where is that going and what can we do to cut that back? And it's a good exercise to do anyway, because the amount of money that you spend is really the primary dictator of where you are financially, of how secure you are, how much you need to retire, how much you should invest, how much you should have, when you can retire. All those things is dependent on what you spend. So it's a good time for people to take a look at their spending, analyze it, and say, okay, what could we cut back here? And could we drive a little less? Could we eat out a little less? Could we buy the generic brand of some item in the supermarket that's less expensive than the name brand option? And, you know, there's plenty of apps out there that you can do to that will track your spending for you. If you're comfortable sharing your spending information, you can go to a place like mint.com. That's the number one most downloaded personal finance app. And what they'll do is they'll help you track your spending automatically that you spend via plastic, like a credit card or debit card. And then you'll know and say, hey, let's go through this together. If you happen to have a partner, significant other, or spouse, they're more than willing to tell you all the dumb stuff that you spend money on and how you can cut that back.
I hear that. We have that discussion at home a lot. So mint.com, I want to mention that we'll put some resources at wpr.org/route51 after the program so folks can review that. I want to ask you about the Consumer Price Index. A lot of discussion about this in the news, but in layman's terms, can you explain what it is? What is the Consumer Price Index? What should we be looking for when those numbers come out?
Yeah, the CPI, or Consumer Price Index, is a basket of goods and services that the government tries to use to not only figure out what's happening with inflation, but also it pegs several different things to a factor based on the Consumer Price Index, such as Social Security benefits are based in part on the inflation index. And when you get a nice bump up inflation, a lot of times you get also a nice bump up in your Social Security check if you're receiving one now or you plan on getting one later. It's a good indicator in general, but everyone's spending is different. And so the Consumer Price Index might be up or down or flat, but your spending might go up a lot. For instance, a lot of people are dealing with childcare right now and trying to find good care and trying to find it at an affordable price. And that doesn't have as big a factor in the Consumer Price Index as it does in the lives of young parents of young children, because it just doesn't apply to everyone. But if you're trying to find daycare or something like that right now, you must think that prices are just going through the moon.
I want to remind listeners that your personal questions are certainly welcome. 800-780-9742. I know there's a lot of confusion right now about what to do with your money. We talked a little bit about how important it is to budget, but I know that planning for unexpected expenses is really important. It's hard, though, to build an emergency fund, especially when money is tight. So is there kind of a formula that you'd recommend? How much do you need to set aside given the current economic outlook? What's the smart thing to do?
Well, it's very difficult because a lot of people, even before inflation hit, were finding that their money just came in and that it went out right away. And you know, fewer than something around half of American households have less than $500 in their checking account and can cover emergencies. The ideal amount is to have 6 months of your living expenses set aside. And the reason you want to have 6 months of living expenses set aside is that gives you 6 months of survival before you, if you lose your job and don't have an income coming in. And again, that's a very optimistic goal, but even 1 month or 2 months of living expenses gives people 1 month or 2 months to look for a job if they should get laid off, if their company closes or something like that. And one thing that people are really tempted to do right now, Shireen, is to say, geez, things are really getting tough right now. We're spending a lot of money. I think I'm going to use my savings to pay off debt. And that could be a big mistake, especially if it's low interest debt like your mortgage or even a car loan or something like that. What people should do instead is just make the minimum payments and keep building up their cash stash until they get to at least a few months worth of living expenses set aside. And yes, credit cards, they should probably pay those off as quickly as they possibly can because the interest rate can spiral out of control and it really hurts their credit rating if they need to borrow money again. But otherwise, don't pay off debt any faster than you have to. Just keep that savings set aside as an emergency fund, at least until you get 3 to 6 months of your living expenses set aside.
There are some apps out there that help with savings, like Digit is one of them, where it just automatically will round up, you know, a couple, it'll save maybe $3 or $4 a day that you might be spending on coffee and putting it into a savings account. It's so hard for people who are living paycheck to paycheck to save money. We touched on this a little bit, but how can you break out of that? How can you change your mindset in an economy like this where you know you've got to have some cash set aside?
It's very difficult to do, but it definitely involves a lifestyle change. And when things are going really well, it's easy to kind of get caught up in that and start, you know, like you said, getting coffee and getting lattes and things like that. Tiny little incremental changes like making your own coffee or making your own lunch and bringing it if you have the time and the energy and ability to do it really makes a big difference for it. But another thing, too, is that, you know, I've done this as a financial advisor now for 34 years. So I've worked with three different generations now of people. And one of the things that, you know, when you think about our grandparents or our great grandparents going through the Depression, not only did they live a very frugal life to get through that because they had to, but many of them picked up a second job or a third job or something like that. And that's very difficult to think about doing because nobody feels like, gee, I have a bunch of extra free time sitting around. I think I'll go get a job. But after you've cut your spending down to whatever you possibly can, for several people, the best solution for them might be to say, hey, I'm going to go up and see if there's another job out there. And there are lots of jobs out there. And we referred earlier to spending $4,000 a month, let's say. And let's say your expenses have gone up 10% due to inflation. So now you're spending $4,400 a month. Well, if you can find a part-time job for about 5 or 6 hours a week, that will more than cover the cost of your extra lifestyle. And, you know, there are those jobs out there. Just about every place you look has a sign up. And a lot of those employers are so anxious to get people who are willing to work and able to work that they can be very accommodating right now to people's schedules. So if you say, hey, I'm going to pick up a, you know, work a Saturday morning or something like that, that's a great way to pick up extra cash to help offset rising prices.
You're listening to Kevin McKinley on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on money management and protecting your financial future. Coming up, we'll discuss the stock market, cryptocurrency, retirement planning, and more. And your personal questions are welcome. Give us a call at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We've got a lot of what it takes to get along.
Welcome back to Route 51, where financial advisor Kevin McKinley is our guest for a discussion about making the most of your money. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. Well, the stock market's a pretty scary thing for a lot of us right now. And I mean, even the most experienced stockbrokers I know are just shaking their heads. And it's really hard to know where to put your money. Do you think there are any so-called recession-proof investments that you could recommend for, like, for example, buying stock in utilities or gold? What's the best thing to do?
Utilities and gold and investments like that have done relatively well in the last 6 months, and that's because they're viewed as being more recession-proof, and especially in light of inflation. But some of the best investments out there are some of the simplest. For instance, right now there are CDs out there at banks or credit unions that pay 2 or 3%. They're much harder to find. The average interest rate on a five-year CD right now in America is still right around 0.5%, and banks really and credit unions quite frankly, don't really want savings because they're having a difficult time lending it out to qualified lenders in a way that they can still be profitable and meet the regulations for the lender's quality. One of my favorite investments out there that's I wish we could put billions of dollars into it are known as Series I savings bonds. You can find those at treasurydirect.gov. That's treasurydirect.gov. Series I saving bonds are issued by the United States government. They are the safest investment you can possibly find. They are currently paying an interest rate of 9.62%. And that interest rate is reset every 6 months according to inflation. Not only is that interest rate extremely high, again, 9.62%, but it's exempt from state taxes. So residents who live in higher tax states, that interest rate is the equivalent of getting a 10% equivalent yield. The bad news about these is that you can only buy $10,000 per person per year. You can't purchase them in an IRA or a Roth IRA, and you can only purchase them online rather than in person. They're stored electronically. They're not issued in a paper form like the savings bonds we might have received from when we were kids from our grandparents or so. And when you go through this this process of opening an account at treasurydirect.gov, it's really cumbersome. You should set aside an afternoon to do it because it can really be a drag. Once you get the account established, it's much easier to purchase these bonds in the future. And for people who are able to pile some money up in savings, those Series I savings bonds are the best thing out there right now.
How do they work? How long do you have to hang on to them before you can cash them in?
That's a good question. It's difficult to get the money out after the first 12 months. So don't put anything in there that you might think you're going to spend during the rest of this year for sure. Technically, it's a 30-year bond. But after holding the bond for 12 months, if you pull it out, there's just a penalty of 3 months of interest. And after 5 years, there's no penalty to withdraw the money. So the sooner you get the money into these bonds, the sooner that clock starts ticking for the 12 months and the 5 years, et cetera. And you get to decide when you declare that interest for tax purposes, meaning you can declare it every year as it's rolled up into the bond each year, or you can wait until you cash them in. So for people who are in a higher income tax bracket right now where they're working and will likely be in a lower tax bracket in retirement, it's a great way to build up some cash. It's kind of like an IRA almost, except you don't need any earned income to make the deposit.
And again, that was treasurydirect.gov. We will put some resources at wpr.org/route51 after the program so folks can access those easily. Where do you see oil prices going? Is investing in oil smart right now, or is that about to crash?
Well, I don't know. Crash is probably a pretty strong word. The demand is going to be high. There's a lot of different factors right now that are driving the production of oil and the price of it. Gas prices have just started to drop a little bit. It'll still seem really high. One of the interesting things I saw, and this was from the Department of Energy, was a chart that showed the inflation-adjusted price of a gallon of gas over the last 40 years. And it seems like gas prices have gone all over the place from, you know, a buck something a gallon up to five something a gallon, depending on where and when you're filling your tank. But what they showed is that, and this was just up until the last 6 months or so, gas adjusted for inflation has almost always been right around $3.20 per gallon. And again, that's adjusted for inflation. And so we just noticed this big spike, in part because of the war in Ukraine, in part because of demand, and then also because the oil producers are not as interested in taking the risk to produce more energy as they might have been a few years ago, which is going to keep demand relatively high. The good news is the vehicles that we are seeing come off the production lines generally are more fuel efficient. There's just more people driving and more people purchasing gas, so that will keep the price artificially high for a decent amount of time.
When it comes to investing, what are your thoughts on using apps like the Robinhood and Webull? Are there tips for people who are using those in this type of economic situation when the stock market is so volatile? What do you think?
I think those are basically legitimized gambling, for to be blunt about it, because it really requires a mentality of checking things on a minute-to-minute basis and trading on a minute-to-minute basis. And I think, you know, getting people into investing for the first time is fantastic, but using apps to buy a tiny share of stock and then sell it for a few cents is gambling. And if you're comfortable with losing money in gambling, I think they're great. But if you say, no, I want to be an investor, what investors generally have done and how they've made money over decades, lots of money, is by buying a good company and then forgetting about it. And a lot of us, you know, don't have that luxury. But the good thing about those apps is they allow you to get in to stocks for a relatively low dollar amount. You don't need $10,000 or $100,000. You can do it for $10 or $100. But the bad news is it encourages people to check it on a regular basis, much like they might do, you know, their texts or social media or TikTok or something like that.
Sure. And if you see a stock that you bought that's gone down, it can be tempting to say, I want to get rid of it. I'm worried I'm going to lose more money. So what can investors do to endure these big fluctuations? What's the best? Should you just sit on it?
The best way that people do make money in stocks is by just buying them and with money that they really can afford to lose. And the ironic thing about that, whether that's $1 or $1 million, is when you're using money that you can afford to lose, you don't worry about it as much. So only put money in that you can afford to see technically go to zero. That's not going to happen with most stocks and especially with mutual funds. But then forget about it and just keep piling the money in on a regular basis. If you have a retirement plan at work, bump that up. And if you're younger especially, try to be as aggressive as you can stand to be on that. And then just don't look at it. That's investing and other financial issues are very ironic that more information is often bad, and because it gets your head spinning. If you find one expert who says X, you can find someone who's just as smart who says Y, and it can really be confusing. So a good disciplined investment strategy, say, I don't care if it's $1 a week or if it's $100 a month or $1,000 a month, is just put it into the account on a regular basis and try not to look at it.
So if you are kind of discouraging using those apps, is it better to take your money and talk to a financial person and say, here, do with this what you will? What should people do?
That's good to do if you can afford it, but good financial advice is difficult to find and it's very difficult to afford. For better or for worse, it's very hard for people just starting out to find good financial advice from a person, because a lot of times the cost that a financial advisor might charge to give them the advice or set up a financial plan or even manage their money is more money than the people actually have to start investing. But the positive part of where we're at today is that firms like Vanguard and Schwab and I think Personal Capital is one, a lot of these larger firms have automated services that, no, you don't get to sit down for and have a cup of coffee with an experienced advisor for 2 or 3 hours at a time every year, but they do have portfolio templates and questionnaires you can use to get started for relatively low dollar amounts. And then in many cases, there is kind of a backup financial planner or customer service person who can answer questions that you have.
Great. Well, I want to ask you a little bit about crypto before we move on from the stock market. I realized, I was trying to talk to my mother about crypto the other day, and I realized that I had a hard time even explaining to her what it is. So what is crypto? How is it regulated? And is it worthwhile at this point?
Well, in terms of, you know, the actual technology of it, I can barely turn my phone on in the morning, so I can't explain that. But what I can explain, the investment aspect to it, and the way that I like to tell people how it works, is it's no different than if all of a sudden people decided that sticks and branches were currency. Like if the store would allow you to bring a big pile of sticks and branches in to buy groceries, people would go crazy and they'd start grabbing all the sticks and branches that they possibly could. They'd strip the trees bare, they'd cut them down, everything like that. And that would work as a currency until it doesn't. And once it doesn't, then all of a sudden people are stuck with a bunch of sticks and branches and they don't have anything that they can use to buy for it. So cryptocurrency has lots of advocates who are really excited about trying to get the average person into that. But there's nothing in there that creates any value whatsoever. You know, even when people who are old enough to remember the dot-com stock boom 20 years ago, at least those companies, you know, pets.com actually sold something. It had a website. There was a distribution center. Cryptocurrencies have no value whatsoever. And if you really want to, you know, flummox an advocate of crypto, say, what is the actual purpose of these? Like the real end use of what can be done with crypto but can't be done with dollars or pesos or euro or anything like that. And they have a very difficult time coming into it. And it really feels to me like a big pump and dump where the larger people who hold this are trying to get the smaller people to get in on crypto and provide an exit strategy for the larger people by buying their crypto from them.
I want to remind folks that we will do our best to answer your personal finance questions. If you call 800-780-9742, you can email ideas at WPR.org. And we do have an email from Diane. She has a question for you. She said, I have two children currently in master's grad school programs. I continue to put money monthly into a 529 plan invested as in school funds. With the current state of the economy, would it be better to just put it in cash holding in the 529 versus investments because of the short time period? Post-grad school, they hope to attend law and medical school. Does that make sense?
Are you asking me if it makes sense for them to attend law and medical school or to deposit? Good for them. It sounds like they're really working hard, and I'm glad Diane has the resources to help them out. Yeah, just for people who don't know, a 529 plan is a government-established college savings plan where you might get a small tax break. Like Wisconsin has its EdVest plan, which gives you a small state income tax break on deposits. It's not a lot, but it certainly helps. And then there's a roster of investment options within the 529 plan from which depositors can choose. And they can be super conservative or they can be really aggressive or somewhere in between, kind of like our retirement plans at work. And then in theory, anyway, any growth is sheltered from taxation. And then if the money is pulled out for qualified higher education expenses, which that definition is fairly generous, there's no taxation on it at all. But the problem is of course, if you're doing this to put money in and pull it out right away, you're only getting the state income tax break. And even that can't generally be done instantaneously. You can't just put a dollar in, pull it out tomorrow and get the state income tax break. So yeah, if the money's going to be spent in 2 to 3 years, it may not even be worth it to put the money in the 529, depending on the effort to get it in and get it back out again. And it's definitely something where you don't want to take a very aggressive stance with the investments. Some of these have like a money market option, which might make, you know, 0.25% a year. Other ones have a CD, like a certificate of deposit option, that might pay a little bit more. But no, those are best for investments that are going to have at least 5 to 10 years to accumulate, hopefully, before you have to pull the money out. It's very different in saving for college than saving for retirement, because you can save for retirement for 40 years and then your retirement's likely to last 20 or 30 years. Whereas with college savings, you might realize that, oh my gosh, this 10-year-old might go to college someday, and so I should start saving. Well, then you only have 5 to 10 years to save, and then it's going to be exhausted in hopefully 4 or 5 years. Although I've seen some of these people that manage to make education a 10 or 20 year prospect, so maybe that's a better reason to save in a 529.
All right, so that's a better alternative, or maybe even just pulling the cash out. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Yes.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about housing prices. They are rising, interest rates going up. My adult son, who lives in the Twin Cities, is looking for a house. He's having a horrible time. What are your recommendations for mortgage shopping in this type of market?
Yeah, the mortgage shopping, you have to, you know, find a house and someone who's willing to sell it to you. And there's just, even with the rising interest rates, one of the things that happened is a bunch of people who are probably going to sell their smaller house or even a house that's just not right for them right now took it off the market because they were planning on borrowing money at 3% and now interest rates are at 5 or 6%. So definitely talk with the lender first before you start shopping for a house. And you have to understand that lenders, you know, it seems like they're the gatekeeper of the money, and technically they are, but really mortgage lenders only get paid when they make a loan, and it's their job to make the loan. So they're going to be an advocate for you to try to get the loan. So go to them first, and they'll tell you what you can afford from their standards. That might be higher even than what you want to pay for it. But one of the ways to get around the problem with, you know, rising interest rates, rising house prices, is to try an adjustable rate mortgage. And especially if you're not going to be in the house for more than 5 or 10 years or so, the adjustable rate mortgage starts out with a lower interest rate, and that's fixed generally for 1 year or 3 years or 5 years, and then it can start fluctuating. But usually the increases and decreases are mitigated, meaning that they can't, you know, the mortgage interest rate can't go to 50%, and it can only go up a relative amount every single year. So you can start in, your payment will be lower, you can actually get into the house. And then if interest rates drop in the future, which they will, it might start today and it might not happen for 10 years, but interest rates will decline. And if you're in the house already, then what you can do is you can say, oh, great, we were in an adjustable rate mortgage. It was about to go up to 5%, but now we can refinance. And not only has the value of our home hopefully increased, but we can get a fixed rate mortgage now for, let's just say, 3.5% or 4%. And don't despair about the housing market. The housing market eventually will correct itself. The problem right now is there aren't enough houses being built to handle the demand. There aren't enough materials, or at least the materials aren't priced in a way that people feel they can afford it. And then they just, again, the same old story, they can't find the workers who are able to build a house for them. Eventually that will fix itself. But for the time being, for young adults, it's really annoying. I would just say, hey, stay in the apartment for a while. Keep building up your savings as well as you can. You will find a house.
What about for people who have been in their house for 10 years? Is it tax-wise, is it better to keep the mortgage or pay off the house?
Tax-wise, with the way the laws are set up right now, the mortgage is not as advantageous as it once was, in part because the standard deduction is so high that usually the interest most people pay on their mortgage isn't high enough to have it be counted as an itemized deduction. Where I'm way more interested in people not paying off their mortgages because they probably have an interest rate that's about 3 or 4% at the most. And that may be the cheapest money they ever borrow for the rest of their lives. And so if they are not contributing to the maximum to their retirement plans or work, or building up savings for expenses or whatever, it feels good to pay off a mortgage, but it can be the biggest mistake people can make. And it feels like it's a smart thing to do to pay that mortgage off, but you're actually safer to have the mortgage and the money than you are to have no mortgage and no money. Because if something comes up where you lose your job suddenly or have a big emergency expense, it's very difficult to get a new mortgage at that time. And you're probably going to pay a higher interest rate now than what it was when you originally took it out. And so it would be much better off for people to just pay that off very, very slowly, keep building it up. And like I said, there are CDs out there that, you know, CDs are as safe as you can get as an investment, that pay close to 3% or more. And so there's actually the unique feature where people say, well, I have $50,000 left on my mortgage and I have $50,000 in my savings account. Technically, you'd be better off taking that $50,000 and buying a CD at 3% than paying off a mortgage that's costing you 3% a year.
You're listening to Financial Advisor Kevin McKinley on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on making solid financial choices in the face of an economic downturn. Your questions are welcome, too. Give us a call at 800-780-9742 or email questions to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back on Route 51, I'm Shereen Seewert with our guest, financial advisor Kevin McKinley. Kevin is happy to answer your personal financial questions as well as we continue our discussion on making the most of your money during difficult economic times. What would you like to know? Email us, ideas@WPR.org, or join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. There are a lot of reasons that people struggle to keep a good credit score. So what's considered a good score? What goes into that number? And what's the best way to keep it up?
The credit score is kind of a simple way for finance companies to gauge how good of a borrower you are. And it's just a start. And, you can have a really good credit score, but for some reason not get a loan. Or you can have a poor credit score, but you can still get the loan. The average score in the United States right now, somewhere around 700 or so. And that bumped up actually in the last few years because people had more money that that they had received and saved because they weren't going out. And they got some government assistance. And so they were able to pay their bills off faster. Now with inflation, they're starting to tap their savings a little bit more. So hopefully they can do that and not have to put their credit up more and build up how much money they owe. But it's based in part on the amount of credit you have, the amount of available credit that you have relative to how much you're using, the timeliness of your payments, and then also your credit score. Some people have, told me, they said, I pay all my debts off right away, and yet my credit score is 750 or 760. I'd like to get it up in the 800s. How do I do that? And part of your credit score is actually predicated upon how much money you will make for the lender. And so if you never pay any interest, you're not likely to make money for the lender, and therefore your credit score is going to be a little bit lower. And a credit score is actually very important, not just for borrowing money, but your auto insurance and your ability to rent and all those kind of things can also be affected by your credit score. So it's a very good idea to just make sure you always make at least the minimum payment on time and don't let the balance get up past usually 20 to 30% of the available credit. So if you have a credit card, let's say we have a $5,000 allowable credit limit on that card, try not to let it float for more than $1,500 or $2,000 on a given month, because that credit utilization ratio would then be higher than a third, and then that would negatively affect your credit score.
We have Paula on the line from Rhinelander. Thanks for calling, Paula.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm invested in a 457, and which is close to me to further contributions because I'm retired. And I'm wondering if I should move the low earning, the stable value and the FDIC bank option, which are earning about 1%, to like mutual fund options, or if I should withdraw that and put it in savings I bonds. Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks, Paula.
That's
Kevin,
it's a really good question, Paula. And it's one that, we struggle with all of our clients who are retiring, is to say, hey, I have a limited investment option within this at-work retirement plan, whether it's a 403B or a 401K or a 457. And you actually hit upon something in your question, Paula, that's really important to me. And that is that in that plan, that stable value option that you referred to, that is not as safe as they make it appear to be, but it's still fairly safe. It's not as safe as the CD, but it's pretty safe. It's basically a contract with an insurance company that says, hey, we're going to pay you, let's just say 2% a year, and we're going to keep that in the name stable value. And you can't duplicate that when you move that to some other place, like a Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity or with some financial advisor or something. They usually can't offer something that's exactly the same and as advantageous as a stable value. So I would be hesitant to move it out of that 457 plan completely, because once you do, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to get it back in there. So I'd rather have you move a portion of it out. And keep in mind, a lot of 457 plans already have those kinds of mutual funds within there. And many of them are low-cost options, like the ones that Vanguard provides. And so it might be, you know, jumping out of the frying pan into the fire to take it out and put it into a mutual fund anyway, but you shouldn't necessarily need it to move it into a separate mutual fund. And I definitely wouldn't want you to take that money out to put it into the Series I savings bonds, because when you pull the money out of the 457 or a 401k or 403b, that's taxable income. So if you're pulling it out anyway, like let's say you have a required minimum distribution, that's fine then to put that money into the Series I savings bonds. But I'd rather have you avoid paying any extra taxes that you don't have to pay just to get the Series I savings bonds, and try to use money that you would otherwise have in, you know, your checking account that you're kind of building up for rainy day savings. And then another thing that was interesting about the question about getting a low interest rate, and especially in these times when, you know, people have realized that stocks can go down and can go down a lot and can even stay down a lot, is if you have two different investment choices, and I'll go back to that 3% example, and let's say portfolio A is going to give you 3% guaranteed for 5 years. Well, if portfolio B says, no, we're going to give you 10% a year in 4 out of the next 5 years, but in one of the years, and we don't know which year that will be, it's going to drop 30%. Well, your average rate of return works out to 1 or 2% in portfolio B. And that's only true if after you lose 30% of the value, you're willing to stick it out and go back, wait for it to go back up again. And so this is a very good example. Like I've talked with my kids even about the tortoise and the hare, is sometimes the tortoise wins the race, and it wins the race in a way that's a lot less stressful for people to have to tolerate.
The number to call, 800-780-9742. We have Vicki on the line from Minocqua. Welcome, Vicki.
Hello.
Hi, what was your question?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we sure can.
Hi, just wondering, we have retired early. We are 55, and we have all of our debt paid off. Our house, very little credit card debt, maybe $900 to $1,000. And looking for... And I'm not sure if this is a repetitive question or not, but looking for what's best to invest in, commercial, residential, another business, just trying to find what's the best bang for your buck, I guess, for investing.
Yeah, Vicki, first of all, congratulations. And when we had the show On Your Money way back when on Wisconsin Public Radio, I loved it when, you know, people like you would call. And it's well deserved, but it sounds a little braggy. And I'm happy that you're in this point of your life where you get these choices and you actually get to enjoy your retirement. It's one thing to be able to retire; it's another thing to do it at a relatively young age that allows you to be physically able to spend your time the way that you want to. Do you have any experience, Vicki, in owning commercial or rental real estate?
No, we don't. We have businesses, but we don't. We just due to some health problems with my husband, that's why we kind of retired early to enjoy life. But we want to, what's it called, a residual income.
Sure.
We're kind of searching for a residual income to sustain, because I know the downfall will meet the red before we get too old if everything works out good that way. So just kind of researching a book to read. I know we've done like Kawasaki and a bunch of other books, but kind of searching for what do we do now in a bad investing time right now.
It's really difficult. You know, real estate is a great way to get rich extremely slowly with a lot of work. You know, a lot of us know people who own rental properties and they've had them for several years. And there's always a story of, you know, oh, my brother-in-law, he just goes golfing every morning and then collects his rental check at the end of the day. Well, what people don't realize is the amount of time and effort and energy and, quite frankly, risk that the brother-in-law took to get to those rental real estate properties. And I've seen, you know, I've had friends and clients who own millions and millions of dollars of real estate, and the cash flow is awesome and everything like that. But they also have had, they've said, well, I've said, well, gee, I see that, you know, you're buying a house in town. Why is that? When you, I know you've got some land out in the country, I thought you were going to build there. And they said, when there's a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning that says the toilet's clogged, I'm the one who has to get up and go do that. If you're willing to do that and you have the ability to do that and do that kind of work, it can be a really good way to get some cash flow, but it's definitely earned income by either the amount of risk you take or the amount of time you have to put into it. And a lot of times when you run the numbers, you say, hey, you know, we could put our money into safe stuff like CDs and these Series I savings bonds, or we could put it into real estate. The risk and the amount of net income you might make is so small, you might say, hey, we'd be better off taking the third shift at Quick Trip to get some extra income and with a lot less headache and a lot less hassle.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. Appreciate it. I want to talk about 401ks. A lot of job changes over the last few years. People were laid off. They changed jobs. If somebody has a 401k sitting there from a previous job, what should they do with it? Should they just let it sit, put it somewhere else? What?
Usually the best thing to do with that job, especially if you're well before retirement, is either leave it in the 401k or, if it's an option, move it into the new retirement plan that you have. You don't want to leave that dormant. Some 401k providers make ex-employees take their money and take it elsewhere. Other ones encourage them to leave it there. But you definitely want to keep an eye on it. And again, you don't want to give up access to some of the benefits of 401ks just because you left your job. For instance, 401ks have a feature in there that allow separated employees at age 55 or older to get access to the money without paying a 10% penalty on it. They still pay taxes on any withdrawals at that point, but it's a lot harder to avoid that 10% penalty if you move it into an IRA and then try to take it out before reaching age 59 and a half. And there are also investment options that are usually low cost in 401k plans that you have to pay more for or don't even have access to if you move it into an IRA. So it's nice to have the control over an IRA. I'd prefer that people, especially younger workers, pay attention to that 401k, but try to move it into their new workers. And then a lot of times people who have taken a new job can't contribute to a retirement plan like a 401k for the first year or so. So definitely make a contribution to a tax-deductible IRA for that year time if you can afford it. And contributions to tax-deductible retirement plans are the best use of a worker's money because you get an instantaneous return on your investment in the form of a lower tax bill.
Is it ever a good idea to cash in life insurance early if you find yourself strapped for cash?
Absolutely. If you find yourself strapped for cash, definitely. If you have and you have cash value life insurance, I mean, it's an in case of emergency break glass kind of situation. But yes, that's a good source of cash. You don't have to cash it in. You can borrow against it, which to a certain extent will keep the life insurance in force. The bad news about cash value life insurance, though, is that usually most people who need it can't afford to buy enough of it to really provide security for their loved ones. And so most people who are younger and have either a stay-at-home partner or children or both, they should buy term life insurance instead. And they'll find that it's much, much cheaper to buy a huge term life insurance policy than it is to get a cash value policy. And there's a website called termforsale.com, T-E-R-M, the number 4, and then sale, SALE.com, termforsale.com. And you can enter in your data without, you know, committing to it or getting a phone call or something and see what a term life insurance policy would cost. So if people are trying to get money in a hurry but still are worried about losing the life insurance, get a term policy instead of the cash value one. Don't cancel the cash value one, though, or pull it all out until you get the new term life insurance policy.
and that is termforsale.com. We will put a list of resources at WPR.org/Route 51. We've got about 45 seconds left, and I guess what's the biggest piece of advice you can give us for navigating our way through the next few months, especially if a recession does happen?
You are in better shape, first of all, than many Americans. Second of all, than you think you are. It's stressful, and especially we're accustomed to kind of having the wind at our back. You will get through this. It does require some buckling down and some new attention to your finances, but don't get too stressed about it. Take all the action that you possibly can.
And it sounds like we are in control of some of it, yes?
Correct.
All right. Again, we will put a list of resources at WPR.org/Route 51. And again, thanks for listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Extending a sincere thanks to our guest, Kevin McKinley. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Kate Springer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Joy is our on-air producer today. The special music today that you heard was from Dire Straits, Bing Crosby, Bread, and Blake Shelton. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at WPR.org/Route 51. You can also subscribe to our podcast each week. It's available from your favorite platform. If you have an idea for a future program or a future guest, feel free to email us at ideas@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you and hear your ideas. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we most certainly hope you join us again. Until next week, we're heading out of town.
Six-pack on the carpet tastes like a million-dollar bill. You can make a one-bedroom apartment feel like a house up on a hill. You can make my truck out in the driveway roll like a cleaned-up Cadillac. Girl, looking at you, looking at me that way can make a man feel rich on minimum wage. Girl, your love is money. Your love is money. Yeah, your love can make a man feel rich on minimum wage. Girl, your love is money. Your love is money. Yeah, your love can make a man feel rich on minimum wage. Girl, your love is money. Your love is money. Girl, your love can make a man feel rich on minimum wage.